The state is a product of society at a certain stage of development. It is the admission that this society has become entangled in an insoluble contradiction with itself, that it is split into irreconcilable antagonisms, which it is powerless to dispel. But in order that these antagonisms, these classes with conflicting economic interests, might not consume themselves and society in fruitless struggle, it had become necessary to have a power seemingly standing above society that would alleviate the conflict and keep it within the bounds of order. And this power, arisen out of the society, but placing itself above it and alienating itself more and more from it, is the state. Now, this was how the revolutionary Frederick Engels described the state in words which I think are just as true today as when he first penned them in 1884. Well, if you've come into contact with socialist alternative before, or certainly with Marxist ideas, you'll know that we talk about class a lot. We think the main divide in society is between social classes, between that small minority of people in our world, the capitalists or the ruling class or the parasites, as they are sometimes called, the people that own and control most of the wealth in our society. And then there's the majority of us who work for a living and produce all the wealth in our society. But then that raises the question, then if the capitalists, be them a very tiny minority in our society, how can they remain in power without the masses of us just simply taking back what is rightfully ours? So the state is a vital institution that the capitalists have to maintain their rule and their power over society. Whilst the state constantly presents itself as being a democratic and a very neutral body, hovering above the class divisions within society, I want to argue that it is profoundly undemocratic and is firmly on the side of the capitalist class. That the role of the state, in the words of Marx, is to manage the common affairs of the bourgeoisie. It is not an institution which can be captured or taken over to be used for good, but it is in fact an obstacle to radical change. The capitalist state is an instrument of class rule and is precisely designed to maintain and upheld the wealth and power of the capitalist class and their system. Okay, so what is the state? The parliament, the police force, the army, the navy, the judiciary, the prison system, and the education systems are its dominant institutions. And under capitalism, these arms of the state help maintain the best possible environment for the bosses to exploit labour in order to produce their profits. And for all the talk of democracy in Australia, with the exception of members of parliament and councils, none of the heads or general positions in any of these institutions are even elected. So let's go through some of these, starting with the police. Well, a major aspect of the state apparatus is repression, and for that, the state has a monopoly on violence. The police force, the army, and the navy are at its disposal to maintain law and order. And there's certainly a nauseating amount of shows on TV depicting cops as as crime solvers, and primarily being concerned with the health and safety and the property of everyone. Yet this image is an absolute myth. That their seemingly benevolent activities, such as directing traffic, are merely a cover or a distraction from their real role in society. And really, as if you have to carry a gun and handcuffs to be able to direct traffic. Like, generally, traffic lights manage fairly well at this most of the time. But the police exist primarily to protect property and the rich, and to physically repress any challenge to their system. So the police keep law and order, we're told. But whose law is it? Well, when we think that 90% of Australian law relates to property, and that in Australia, nearly half of the total wealth is owned by the top 10%, it becomes clear who the police actually are protecting, whose property they're actually protecting. And in relation to most, petty property crimes like house theft or things like that, police are effectively taxpayer-funded inspectors for insurance companies. So we know whose law it is. Well, whose order is it? Well, let's think, if Rupert Murdoch theoretically was to break into a shop and steal a TV, well, we think he would be charged with theft in the same way that I would. No doubt he, if he was, put in jail, he'd probably get weekend jail, whereas I would not have that benefit. But the capitalists don't need to do this. They don't need to break into shops, particularly not Rupert Murdoch. He already bloody controls what's on the TV. But the capitalists steal absolutely every single day, every minute of every day. That all the profits the companies make come from the gulf between the wealth that workers produce and what they are paid in wages. And without this theft, this exploitation, there would be no profits at all. Yet, this isn't considered theft by the police. This is simply business. This is business as usual. The order of the day. And the police are certainly its loyal servants to uphold this order. And the harshest repression from the police is always against workers' strikes or demonstrations, which are met with these armed thugs of the state. Now, to physically enforce their rule, I think the capitalists need to have a section of the population whose full-time job it is to do so. To have a section of the population that is separated as much as possible from the mass of ordinary people. To have special powers to surveillance people, to arrest, to detain, to be disciplined, and to think that ordinary people are the problem in society. And endemic problems of corruption in the police force, I think, are an inevitable byproduct of actually giving police the power and the discretion that they need if they're to be a reliable force to enforce class rule. However, this, every now and then you get this sort of corruption, scandals and things like that in the police force. But I think this is a very small price to pay for an institution that is always available to smash picket lines, to break up demonstrations, intimidate individuals, and create, moral panics about law and order. And for anyone here that has the benefit of living in Victoria, particularly in Melbourne, you know that there's sort of a perennial panic about law and order that always goes on, particularly about street violence. But the cops never talk about, deaths in the workplace. Now, there's over 7,000 workers that die every year from workplace-related injuries and diseases. It's actually the fifth biggest killer in Australia. Yet, the cops do not go on about CEOs of companies having neglectful parents or having, decaying morals, because their role is not about policing their behaviour, it's about policing ours. And even the Victoria Police website has some quite enlightening material on its history section, as it brags about how police shot and killed 30 rebels during the Eureka Stockade. And then it goes on to say, and I'm not making this up, the history of Victoria Police has also been marked by World War I, the Depression period, followed by problems with unemployment, demonstrations and strikes, and then World War II. By the mid-60s, the population of Victoria passed 2 million, and police were trying to combat gambling issues, a developing youth culture, Vietnam War demonstrations. Throughout its existence, the organisation has remained true to its motto, uphold the right. And the police never come along to demonstrations or to strikes to hear both sides. They come along bringing the threat or the actual use of violence. The biggest mobilisation of police we've seen in Australia in decades was that for the APEC conference in Sydney in 2007, which I was one of many people in Socialist Alternative that went up to Sydney for this. This police operation cost them $24 million every day. So while the rich and powerful at the time, George Bush and Vladimir Putin, when they come to town, well, the state is more than willing to spend all of our money, taxpayers' money, mobilizing thousands of these cops. They bought a new water cannon purely to patrol the streets to intimidate us. They had snipers on roofs looking down at us on the demonstration. It was a demonstration here a year ago in Melbourne against the visiting former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert. You know, this was the man responsible for the absolute destruction of Gaza in January 2 years ago now, where over 1,400 Palestinians were murdered. Now, he was at the Grand Hyatt Hotel. Now, you think if the police are about, catching, criminals or murderers or things like that, well, they would have stormed the building and arrested Ehud Olmert. But no, they didn't. Instead, they pepper sprayed all of us who were outside trying to protest this guy. Now, the army and the navy export this violence to other parts of the world. And in times of serious class struggle, will be used locally. In fact, when Gough Whitlam was sacked in 1975, there were army units that were actually placed on standby in response to the demonstrations, the mass working class protests that followed. And if you take the time to read the Australian Army's Manual of Land Warfare, it actually contains guidelines for shooting agitators in crowds and actually how to build concentration camps in Australia. So despite the popular images of the police of being friendly and nice, they are not a force for good in society, but they are in fact an enemy to all of us who want to change the world. Okay, let's move on to the court system, the legal system. Well, there's some figures like Bob Brown have claimed that Australia has the best legal system in the world. I would argue it's the best legal system that money can buy. That for adequate representation in court, you can get a really good seniors counsel. They can be hired for about $550 per hour. You think added on to that, solicitors' charges, court fees, the costs of gathering evidence, paying expert witnesses. It certainly adds up. Now, that amount of money, that's a drop in the ocean for any employer or the rich. But for working class people, it's impossible to be able to afford this. That the economic reality of justice trumps any idea of the courts being fair. Now, when the Labor Party shamefully said that they would maintain most of work choices on the books, particularly the removal of protection from unfair dismissal for small businesses, Julia Gillard, before she was Prime Minister, said at the time, well, that's okay because if you're unfairly discriminated against in your workplace, well, you can just take your employer to court. It's still illegal for them to do that. Well, an unfair termination case will cost up to $40,000 to pursue. It can take up to 3 years, which for most workers actually means the threat of personal bankruptcy to pursue. Which certainly means putting your house, if you have one, your car, or any other, worldly possessions that you have, up for grabs. Whilst an employer can easily, pay for this and drag out the court proceedings, for as long as they want. Now, the court system is always said to be free and fair of any bias. But then, let's look at the judges. Who are they? Like the heads of the police and the army, they're not elected. They're actually appointed by the Governor General and or the state the governors, who are also unelected. Now, judges are selected from the most successful lawyers. Lawyers who mostly come from posh, ruling class backgrounds and more than likely studied law, probably right here at Melbourne Uni. And it's not just any lawyer that gets appointed to be a judge. That you have to have a proven track record of being tough on petty crime, on immigrants, on trade unions, and very soft on your friends, literally your friends, in big business. And with the power and the privilege that judges have, they are certainly part of the ruling class, sharing the same ideology and the same interests as their peers. So let's look at some of the justice that's been meted out in recent years. Let's look at the justice delivered to building company James Hardie. Because it was profitable, for decades, they subjected construction workers to handle asbestos, which has killed over 10,000 workers to date. Now, in the 1930s, they knew that it was harmful, but that didn't stop them. Yet they have never been found guilty of murder. In fact, except in the ACT, industrial manslaughter is not even considered a crime. The only penalty that the directors of James Hardie have ever received was 2 years ago, when some of them were fined for purposefully underfunding their own asbestos compensation scheme. And the biggest fine they were issued was $350,000. Now you think, if any of us was responsible for murdering one person, let alone 10,000 people, you would not be fined an amount. You would be put in jail. You would spend the rest of your life in jail. But if you're a company director earning millions and you're responsible for this, you get a bit of a slap on the wrist. Well, let's look at the justice that's been given out to Bradley Manning. Manning is a 23-year-old soldier in the United States who is currently being held for the leaking of diplomatic cables to WikiLeaks, and is responsible, allegedly responsible, for releasing the collateral murder video. If people are not aware of this, it is a quite shocking bit of footage taken from the war in Iraq, and actually shows a US gunship firing on unarmed civilians, and this range of people that are killed. Several of them turn out to be children, and actually Reuters journalists. They claim that they're insurgents. The video shows an ambulance that arrives to take away some of the people. They fire on the ambulance. They blow it up, and they are laughing. You can actually hear the sound of their voice. Now, Bradley Manning should be treated as a hero for releasing this footage, for actually exposing the war crimes of the United States. But he's not being held up as a hero. He's being treated as a criminal. And actually, for the last 9 months, he's been held in solitary confinement in the United States. That for 23 hours of every day, he is held in solitary confinement. He's not even allowed to exercise. He has constant surveillance on him. If he is caught exercising, they restrain him. He has to strip down to his underwear every single night. Now, he hasn't even encountered the justice system. Even before that, this is the way that he's being treated. And actually, one of the charges that the US are trying to pin on him is a crime of aiding the enemy, which actually means if he's found guilty of this, he could actually face the death penalty for this. And I think another sinister aspect to this is, you think, this is in a country that has a Bill of Rights, that we're always told in Australia, oh, we need a Bill of Rights that will protect our citizens. Well, the US has one, and look at Bradley Manning, or look at Guantanamo Bay. The final aspect of the justice system I want to talk about is the justice that's given to Aboriginal people in this country. But despite the entire history of dispossession and genocide, the first time in Australian history that a police officer was taken to court for murdering an Aboriginal person was in 2004. It was a man called Chris Hurley. An autopsy found the Palm Island man, Cameron Doomadgee, his liver had almost been cleaved in two from the extreme beatings that he received from Chris Hurley whilst in custody, who he then left to rot in a police cell to die. And an all-white jury found Chris Hurley completely innocent of any wrongdoing. Hurley was later then awarded compensation. He was given $100,000 with the claim of property that he lost in the riots that followed the murder of Cameron Doomadgee. So the justice given to Chris Hurley was essentially one of congratulations for murdering another Aboriginal person. Whilst it was only last year that Lex Wootton, who rightfully rioted after Cameron's murder, was actually released from jail. He served a sentence for rioting. And since him being released from jail, he's actually been slapped with a 4-year gag that he is not allowed to talk to the media for the next 4 years. He's not allowed to go to a protest, to a rally. He's not allowed to speak at a public forum. Like, if he came here, he would be arrested and hauled off. And I think it is an utter indictment on the Australian legal system that not a single cop has ever, ever been found guilty of murdering an Aboriginal person in this country. So the problem with the legal system, it's not that we have the wrong people in it, but its entire structure, from its laws that are 90% about property, to its judges that are handpicked by governments from the upper echelons of society, and the absolute favouring of big capital and money over ordinary people. It is a system that is fundamentally flawed, and its image of being fair and completely neutral is a cover for its role of upholding the rights and property of big business. Okay, now I've explained how the police and the legal system are undemocratic and rule for capital. But what about the parliament, which at the very least, well, that is actually elected? Well, in early capitalism, there was a real genuine fear among some ruling class figures of actually having parliamentary democracy, of giving everyone the right to vote. For instance, the late British Lord Thomas Macaulay Babington, it's very British, in the 19th century, he said that universal suffrage would be fatal for all purposes for which government exists, and it is utterly incompatible with the existence of civilization. And that capitalism and indeed civilization has survived, giving everyone the right to vote. It has certainly been able to accommodate giving everyone this right. But this democracy that we have, the parliament, and its elected MPs are said to run the nation. Yet then the question comes, we'll run it in whose interests? And to answer that, I think we have to look at who actually has power in our society. You think on a day-to-day level, most of the issues that affect our lives, you know, how much our rent is, how much house prices, you know, what house prices are, you know, what is the cost of food, what are the interest rates, you know, do you have a job? How much do you get paid when you work? How long do you work for? Well, all these decisions are chiefly made and directly influenced by unelected people. It's the heads of business and the workings of the market. And the key issues that governments are concerned about, you know, the sort of issues which, you know, dominate the business sections of any newspaper, you know, things like the levels of investment, of inflation, of unemployment, of interest rates, trade and budget deficits, all these things. Well, these are the results of a whole multitude of buying and selling and lending decisions that are largely made by big business. So the decisions that big business make have a huge impact on society, which absolutely, you know, pales in comparison to the control we as individual people have and our individual decisions make. And I think it's worth remembering, you know, the stats I said before. You think it's the top 10% that control nearly 50% of the wealth in Australia. And it's this immense power over society that the state is certainly not neutral to this massive imbalance in power. So understanding who has economic power, I think, is vital to understanding who has political power. And this is why our democratically elected governments, whether they be Liberal or Labor, serve the interests of the rich and big business. It's not just the millions of dollars in corporate donations that are given to political parties every year, or all the background dealings that go on. But it's not that politicians, you know, simply have the wrong ideas, but it's built into the very foundations of the state and reflects a reality of capitalism. It's the bosses that hold power, and it's the state that manages its common affairs. I think this is why in 2003, when the majority of people in Australia opposed the Iraq war, the government did it anyway. Or you think today, when a clear majority of people oppose, support ripping up of the anti-union, work choices laws, or things like same-sex marriage rights, the current Labor government refuses. So all politicians and prime ministers know that power ultimately lies with business, and that's who you're ruling for. I think they understand full well that if you're in office and you don't meet the needs of capital, that there is the threat of the ruling class pulling out its investments, of crippling the economy, and thus their electoral prospects. And we certainly saw an example of this last year with the mining tax. That despite mining companies here paying one of the lowest tax rates in the world, an attempt to increase it was met with a whole barrage of TV advertisements and threats to shut down the mines and withhold investment. That their economic power gives them the strength to effectively hold the entire economy and a government to ransom if they try and do something that they don't like. And they won. Instead of the government asserting that, they, the elected representatives, might have some say over how things run in Australia, Rudd was ceremoniously dumped as Prime Minister and replaced by Julie Gillard, who completely capitulated to the mining companies. Mining magnates one, democracy zero. Or as Clive Hamilton, who I don't think is by any means a left winger, actually put in a very scathing opinion piece, it's enough to turn anyone into a Marxist. The much starker example of this was actually the coup in 1975, when all the talk of democracy was done away with, when the Whitlam Labor government was simply overthrown, and Liberal Party leader Malcolm Fraser was appointed Prime Minister. Now, I'll just skip a few things. I'm running a little bit over time. The final aspect of the state I do just want to quickly run through are that of its seemingly benevolent arms. That the state funds things like primary, secondary school education, domestic water, sewage systems, healthcare system, roads, public transport, and many other things. And these are services that obviously socialists don't think we should get rid of any of these things. But we think these services should be massively expanded. But I think we do need to have an understanding of what their role is under capitalism. That if the state is to manage the common affairs of the ruling class, it's in their common interests to have a continual stream of workers that are disciplined, that are educated up to a point, that are healthy enough to get to work every day and can actually get there on time. I think this is the driving motive for the state to deliver social services. But not only are they run to meet the needs of business, increasingly these services are being privatised and run directly for profit, which has led not only to a massive decrease in the quality of these services, they become much more expensive for workers to access. And this has certainly been, been particularly heightened by the global financial crisis and all the austerity measures that are being pushed through Europe and the United States, like the tripling of education fees in Britain, for instance. But the state also has a whole series of institutions that manage the capitalist economy that have, this sort of veneer of impartiality, like the Productivity Commission, or the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission, the ACCC. And, it's a body that, claims to promote competition and fair trade in the marketplace. Now, whilst it occasionally will issue sort of product, recalls and, will offer small fines to companies who sort of openly flaunt the law, when you actually look at sort of major breaches to the law, you can really see whose side these, so-called watchdog organisations are actually on. The largest fine the ACCC has ever issued was to a man called Richard Pratt. In fact, it was actually the largest corporate fine that was ever dished out in Australia's history. Now, Pratt was found guilty of price fixing for cardboard. He was in a cartel with Amcor. And this cartel earned him, you know, a smooth, you know, extra $700 million. He was fined $36 million. And in court, he was actually asked how much he thought he should have to pay as a fine. Now, you think about that. Like, if any of us were to go and steal $700 million, you know, from someone or from a bank, well, you'd have to pay it back. Like, you wouldn't just, like, have to pay back, you know, a small amount. But the thing is, if you're rich and you do that, and if you're, you know, if your personal wealth is, you know, $5.4 billion, you get to walk away even richer. Okay, so to sum up. Well, the state constantly presents itself as being democratic, fair, neutral, but its practice is exactly the opposite. And this is not simply a problem of just having the wrong people in its key positions, but rather its entire structure is undemocratic and is designed to serve the interests of capital. The job of running the state is the job of running capitalism. So the capitalists need to have the state to enforce their rule. They need the parliament for a facade of democracy. They need the courts to uphold their property rights and the illusion of justice. They need the army to dominate and expand their influence outside the bounds of the nation state. And they need the police to physically enforce their rule at home. But behind all these institutions is the reality that the core division in society is between social classes. And the state exists to maintain the domination of this rich minority over the mass of workers who produce all the wealth. That the state apparatus guarantees the capitalists as little disruption as possible to the business of exploiting labour and producing profits. So for anyone here who wants to change society, which I certainly hope is everyone here in this room, the capitalist state should not be viewed as a force for good that could be taken and over and used for our purposes. We should see it as an institution that is a barrier to changing the world. But rather than reforming the capitalist state, we should set our sights on destroying it and establishing a genuine democracy that gives the mass of workers who produce all the wealth in our society direct democratic control.